The following is the fifth part of a 15-part special teaching by Dr. Kenneth Boa on paradigm spirituality.
As you know, we've been in the midst of a series of teachings on what I call paradigm spirituality. A paradigm, remember, is a way of seeing the world, a perspective upon which we embrace our senses, our apprehension, our experience. And we all have a paradigm. We all have a way of seeing. But the scriptures invite us to see life no longer from a temporal paradigm, but from an eternal paradigm. They invite us to see no longer a temporal value system, which is the enemy of the eternal, but to pursue the eternal over the present and the invisible over the visible. Not that the visible and present is meaningless, but rather it's a context for us to ultimately leverage for eternal gain. That this is a very short and fleeting world, and we do well, the more we actually have an eternal perspective to treasure the time, the brief time we have on this planet. So it's really not a matter of being irrelevant, but actually becoming more alive, not less alive, more impassioned by the purposes that God has for us. Because if a man has purpose, if a man has a destiny, then that'll define the journey. You cannot really embrace a journey without getting an idea of your destiny. Because as Yogi Berra once said it, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. Any road will get you there. And so you're in total lack of clarity, a lack of focus in that regard. I won't do all these, but do you ever get these crazy email things that there's no way these can be true. No one can be this stupid. But there are somebody must be very creative here. Perhaps it's possible some of these people said these. For example, if you could live forever, I thought, would you, and this is Miss Alabama, presumably in the 1994 Miss USA contest. I'm not saying she said it. It's just saying this is what, the question was, if you could live forever, would you and why? Answer, I would not live forever because we should not live forever, and because if we were supposed to live forever, then we would live forever, but we cannot live forever, which is why I would not live forever. Gosh, that's scary. this statement is attributed to Marion Barry, mayor of Washington, D.C. Outside of the killings, Washington has one of the lowest crime rates in the country.
That's believable.
That one's believable. I don't know if Lee Iacocca really said this, but this is attributed to him. We've got to pause and ask ourselves, how much clean air do we need? This attributed to Mark Fowler, former Federal Communications Commission chairman. If somebody has a bad heart, they can plug this jack in at night as they go to bed, and it will monitor their heart throughout the night. And the next morning, when they wake up dead, there'll be a record. There's more, but I'm going to stop there. I talked last week, I think it was, about famous last words. Recall I gave you the last words, truly, on the deathbed of P.T. Barnum. Remember what that was? How were the receipts tonight in Madison Square Garden? I've got a few others for you to listen to. And I'm struck by the radical difference between those who know Christ and those who do not. The difference couldn't be greater. Aldous Huxley, as you know, author of Brave New World, and really a humanist. That was his primary endeavor. He said at the end of his journey, it is a bit embarrassing to have been concerned with the human problem all one's life and find at the end that one has no more to offer by way of advice than try to be a little kinder. In other words, a bromide, a platitude. That's the depth that I've arrived at. Try to be a little kinder. Another statement by Socrates, all of the wisdom of this world is but a tiny raft upon which we must set sail when we leave this earth. If only there was a firmer foundation upon which to sail, perhaps some divine word. Isn't that an interesting thing? A desire for some kind of way of negotiating the strange journey of life. And of course, our view is there is such a word. I know I quoted you this one, W.C. Fields on his deathbed as a lifelong agnostic. He was discovered reading a Bible in his deathbed, and I'm looking for a loophole, he explained. words of Sigmund Freud, the meager satisfaction that man can extract from reality leaves him starving. That's an intriguing statement. If you haven't read this book, The Question of God, which is a contrast between C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud by Armand Nicolai, he's a professor of medicine at Harvard and part of the Harvard Medical School, is an intriguing contrast between two worldviews, largely actually derived from their letters, their correspondence. And while he does not actually come down and say, this one's right and this one's wrong, it speaks for itself. And as you come to the end of it, you see that one view, the view of Freud, really leads to total despair and really also had a profound impact on his relationships with others, being a very self-centered person. And Lewis's theism is radically different. In his book years ago called The Intellectuals, Paul Johnson also described and contrasted a number of people who were known to be leaders and really major shapers of our culture. People like Marx and Freud, Henrik Ibsen, the playwright, Rousseau, and others. You know, the interesting thing about all of these, they had something in common. Every one of them had something in common, and it was this: that they were in love with the ideal of humanity, but really hated people. It's very strange, because the people in their lives, they used and tossed them away when they were no longer a utility to them, and that's down to the man. And he carefully demonstrates this very fact, that basically they toss them out like a used pack of cigarettes once they've accomplished their purpose. Marx was a wonderful example. He had the theory of the working of the proletariat. He had that theory, and he really had, I think, some emotion and some passion about that, but he never knew one. It was all theory. It was all, never practice. When it comes down to it, in Christianity, we're not called to love an ideal of humanity, are we? We're called to love people, and there's a radical difference. We're called to love the people that are actually in our presence, in our path, in our lives. And those are the ones we're challenged and called to embrace, not some wispy notion of mankind as some general humanistic task and enterprise. I say this all because at the end of the day, our lives will be shaped by our understanding of our destiny. Let me read you, by contrast, what Napoleon said before his death. I die before my time, and my body shall be given back to the earth and devoured by worms. What an abysmal gulf between my deep miseries and the eternal kingdom of Christ. I marvel that whereas the ambitious dreams of myself and of Alexander and of Caesar should have vanished into thin air, a Judean peasant, Jesus, should be able to stretch his hands across the centuries and control the destinies of men and nations. That's a perceptive comment, is it not? And as I see this, I'm struck by the fact that if we contrasted the power of men and the power of God, the greatest power the world has ever known really cannot grasp the power of the Spirit. There's just no way it can understand. It's a different form of power, is it not? Imagine, if you would, Paul, which was formerly Saul of Tarsus. Now he's Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, and he's standing before Nero. And really, it's a life and death issue. First time that he was brought to Roman imprisonment, he was acquitted, but the second time he knew he would not be. And so in his last letters, what are called the pastoral epistles of 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, he effectively knows that this is going to be it. And he says, I have poured out my life as a drink offering. I've fought the good fight. I've finished the faith. I have been faithful. I have been a man who now knows him at the end of my journey. And effectively what he's telling Timothy is to carry the baton, to go carry it to the next generation. Here's a man who stands before this powerful emperor, Nero. And I imagine Nero in his splendor, in his pageantry, and Paul in his chains and in his poverty. And one might have supposed at that time, wouldn't one, that in the ages hence, that Nero would be imitated and Paul would be pitied. Wouldn't we think that? You'd think that Nero would be the one you'd pursue, and Paul's the one to be pitied. Yet, interesting, 2,000 years later, we call our children Paul and our dogs Nero. I mean, that's quite intriguing, isn't it? And that's an important thing to recall, that all the pomp, all the pageantry, all the splendor of man is as nothing in comparison with the power of a life that's transformed by the indwelling Spirit of God. There is a new power, a new dimension that the world does not understand. Jesus before Pilate, another example of that. What is truth? And he was looking at truth, the incarnation of truth, as he asked that question, and had no understanding. Jesus said, "If my kingdom of my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight. But my kingdom is not of this world." And actually it made Pilate afraid of him, the things that he said. "Who are you?" he asked, which is a great question to ask. Who are you? Because he knew he was dealing with something more than the ordinary criminal. In fact, there was the encounter with great power. I'm thinking about William Shakespeare's last play, and it's called The Tempest. I don't know how many of you have seen The Tempest, but it's about a magician whose name is Prospero, who uses his magic books to actually rule an enchanted island, and he fills it with spirits and beings that serve him. And at the end of the play, near the end of the play, when he addresses his guest Ferdinand in the fourth act, it is as though Shakespeare himself speaks through Prospero. And it's as though Shakespeare is saying to the audience, to his audience at the Globe Theater, that I am coming out now and I am actually speaking to you about my own life, my own destiny, my own journey. Prospero says, "Our revels are now ended. These are players, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself." I think that's an allusion to the Globe Theater, and then beyond that to the whole of all human existence. "Yes, all which in it inherits shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." Is that not incredible? The interesting thing is that at the end of the play then, Prospero gives up his magic, and he turns his thoughts to the grave. And in the same way, the playwright would create no more works on the stage of life. This was to be his last play. Reflecting on the brevity of earthly existence, he understood that the temporal achievements and accomplishments of humanity really would all come to an end. And it's reminiscent of 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. A verse that we would do well to understand, because the scriptures give us a vision of the fiery consumption of all human attainments on the day of God. When Peter says, "The day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up." All of this that we see on the play of life, the theater of life, that great globe itself will dissolve. It'll fade and leave not a rack behind. Yet there is something that will endure, people and the Word of God, and that we will go on into eternity when this world is long gone. And we are the creatures, we are the inhabitants of the new heavens and of the new earth. We already have the life of the kingdom that is to come already manifest within us, because if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Could be translated creature or creation. You are not the same person you were before. Inside out, you've been transformed. In your deepest self, you're now a partaker of the divine nature. 2 Peter 1:4 tells us that you now have a new nature, and it's the life of Christ in you, the Spirit of God in your spirit. And so your deepest self now has been transformed, and our great call in life is to now bring outward self into conformity more and more with the new person we've come become inside. That's why the process of spiritual growth is always inside out, never outside in. The world solutions are always outside in. Have you noticed this? The world solution is if you feed them, if you educate them, if you give them enough wealth, people will be better. Last time I checked, the wealthiest and best educated people were not the best people on the planet. It doesn't seem that that has anything to do with a solution to the human condition. Those are band-aids on a cancer. The best you can do that the world can offer is actually try to be a little kinder. You see, that's the best platitude it can give us. Because it has no depth, it has no basis. You see, I'm more and more impressed with the depth of the Christian vision, as opposed to the shallowness of alternative views, whether it's the New Age variations or the shallowness of basically naturalism or materialism, however you want to describe that. I'm stunned by the depth of this, because instead of saying that, as naturalism says, that ultimate reality is simply material, or as the New Age variations and Eastern philosophies say, that ultimate reality may be spiritual but not personal, some force, some energy, some vibration, some consciousness. But even how can you have a consciousness that actually is unconscious? But it's another story. And in contrast to those, you actually have in the Christian vision a depth that you will never plummet the abyss that is God. His wisdom is infinite, his understanding is unbounded, and you will continue in heaven to grow into the fullness of the person you were intended to be, because I believe heaven is a process. You will be made perfect in your resurrected body, but that does not mean you will be static. You will learn. You will develop. You will grow in relationships with God and with others. And in that process, you will not be bored. I assure you of this. There is actually a philosophical argument against the immortality of the soul that runs this way. If we really would have immortal souls, then it would be a hell, because at the end of the day, we would become totally bored. Totally bored. And that tells me more about the philosopher than it does about the immortality of the soul. That shows me about his deficiency of imagination than it does more about the vision that the scriptures give us. You will not be bored, because God will always be filled with surprises. Frankly, the more we study about nature, the more mysterious it becomes, the more extraordinary it becomes. I took a photo of a dandelion, and it's just, you know, the little puff ball that you've got there. And it turned out extraordinarily well, so it's now on my desktop. I like it so much, and it's a reminder of something that we normally overlook by virtue of the fact that there are thousands, tens of thousands that you would see. Remember, as a child, you'd take the thing and blow on it, and all the little seeds would be scattered. But this, I caught it at the point where it was a perfect sphere, and then you could look at the structure, and it's absolutely exquisite in its complexity. Actually, more impressive than anything an architect has ever been able to achieve. Marvelous in its elegance and its simplicity and beauty, and yet profound in the information that is contained therein. An exquisite and aesthetically pleasing thing, and this is only the surface of God's creation. What do you suppose if this fallen creation is so mysterious and so powerful and so wonderful and so extraordinary? What do you suppose it'll be like when we see the new creation, an unfallen new creation? That's why it says that the eye has not seen, neither has ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of men the things that God has prepared for those who love Him. You do not have the cognitive equipment at this point to embrace it, to understand it. You just do not have the understanding of it that would be sufficient. We go back to the world and its projects. I often think of the fact that in many people's lives, they're doing this dance between two songs. On the one hand, the song is Frank Sinatra, and the other is Peggy Lee. The Frank Sinatra song is I Did It My Way. The Peggy Lee song is that all there is? And so a man does it his way again. And then he asks the same question, is that all there is? And how many iterations do we need to go through before we realize that it's never going to satisfy doing it your way? that life will never really fully satisfy your deepest longings because you are meant for something more. If you really come into contact with your heart's deepest longings, what do you come in contact with? What do you come in contact with? The realization that you have longings that can never be sustained, never satisfied, never really fulfilled in this world. These aspirations cannot, I think, be satisfied by any of the offerings of a transitory world because there's not enough time, there's not enough opportunity, nor is there enough energy in this planet, I think, even to scratch the surface of our deep-seated, God-given hopes and dreams. God has implanted eternity in our hearts, according to Ecclesiastes 3:11. And you cannot eradicate the desire for eternity. It's hardwired. You can try to avoid it by indifference and distraction, but at the end, it's still going to be there, gnawing away at the earthly prospects that seem so promising, but end up having no value, no power whatsoever. I'm struck by the fact that A.W. Tozer, who puts things so well, had a wonderful comment that I have come to use and know. You've probably heard me use this many, many times, but I love it because of its insight. He says, the days of the years of our lives are few and swifter than a weaver's shuttle. Life is a short and fevered rehearsal for a concert we cannot stay to give. Just when we have attained some proficiency, we are forced to lay our instruments down. There's simply not time enough to think, to become, to perform what the constitution of our natures indicates that we are capable of. That's a powerful image, isn't it? Just when we seem to have got some proficiency in the art of life, we're forced to lay our instruments down. You never can actually show up for the concert. All of this is preparation. The concert is ahead. Then it will be glorious because it will be unsullied by human ambition, double-mindedness, pride, vanity, and foolishness. All that will be done away with, and the body of Christ, cell by cell, will be restored into the perfection that is really God's intention. Spot, wrinkle, any other such thing will be removed from her so that she will be holy and blameless and pure, and thus we will be. Now imagine what that concert will be like when all that is best in us is brought out, and all that was wrong, the flesh, is now decisively removed. It's an exciting thought when you think about it. I think even 1 hour in that experience of the communion of the saints, the true communion of the saints, let alone 1 hour in the presence of the Lord God whom you will see face to face in your resurrected body, I believe that would be more than we could handle on this earth. You would not be able to sustain it. It would actually be too intense. You would be disintegrated. You would be undone. No one could look upon him and live. Not in this body. But in the next, it says, Revelation 22, they will see his face. We who were banished from the garden and from God's manifest presence are now destined to be in a city, a garden city, actually, in which ultimately we will see his face. And he will be the one, the Lamb will be the lamp. There will no longer be a need for artificial light because the glory of God will be upon us. It'll be quite remarkable. And it's interesting to think, ask yourself these questions. What impact will what I'm doing today have 100 years from now? In other words, on my life 100 years from now, and on the lives of others 100 years from now. I don't mean on this planet. I mean what I'm doing today really does count for eternity. Because you're not going to be here another 100 years. I hope I'm not telling you something that you didn't know. Don't delude yourself that think that you're going to be here on this planet for another 100 years. Fact is that the years will move quicker and quicker and quicker, and you'll always ask the question, where did the years go? And you'll be always surprised at how fast time goes by and how we've aged and so forth. And I've told you this before. You see somebody you haven't seen in 30 years and you lie to each other. You know, you say you look great, you look terrible. But the fact is that you try to deny the aging process. But the fact is that we are in an earth suit, and this earth suit's wearing out fast. That's why Paul says, I don't lose hope, even though my earthly dwelling, my body is wearing out, yet my inner self is being renewed day by day. So it's that in you, the inward self, the new self that is being renewed day by day. The body will perish, but that which is going to go on into eternity is being renewed and developed on a day-by-day process. I was struck with this prospect as well when I was in a retreat that was in Louisiana. It was in Hammond, Louisiana, at the Episcopal Retreat Center there. And there were about 75 men, and I sometimes go down there to speak to these guys from Baton Rouge, from New Orleans, from Covington, Mandeville, Slidell. Some of these guys I've known now for 25, 30 years. Some of them, of course, you meet for the first time. But there's always a remarkable unity of spirit that takes place when you go to such a thing. One of the most wonderful experiences we had on that particular retreat, it's one of those moments you cannot plan. You've all had moments like that? Something that you could not have planned, and you know it's a treasure, it's a gift. You've been given it as a gift. It's what people in New Orleans would call lanyap, on the house. It's grace. And you can't keep it going, it'll stop, and you know it'll stop. But then in heaven, the music will never stop. It'll continue. But in this particular experience, there were six of us. I spoke on Friday night, and after the Friday night session, a lot of us were out under the stars in the causeway, in the breezeway between two of the buildings. I don't know if I should tape this or not, but we were smoking fabulous Cohiba Cubans and Monte Cristo number twos, you know. But we also, that one of the guys, there were six of us, six of the guys from Baton Rouge, and the animated conversation was glorious. One of these guys brought four bottles of wine, and another guy brought two bottles of wine. Let me tell you what I'm just going to mention those four bottles for a minute, because they have a powerful symbolic significance and do relate to what I'm talking about. Jim White, who's a physician, decided to bring these four bottles because he wanted to share them with his friends. What he said was this. He said that I want to enjoy it now with my friends rather than die and leave it behind. That's a powerful picture. I asked Jim to write down what those wines were. I'd never remember them, but it was magical. Each one seemed better than the one before. I'll tell you what he gave us. First of all, it was a Chateau Lafite Rothschild from 1976. Then it was a Chateau Muetto Rothschild from 1970. Chateau de Creux Bucciolo, 1979. And Casa de Sonoma, 1947. We guzzled them all down. And it lasted. It was a magical evening of 4 hours, with the presence of people that you love, and enjoying the goodness of God's creation. That's a good thing. Don't hoard. Don't be stingy. God hates hoarding and stinginess, but He loves extravagance and generosity. The extravagance of the alabaster vial. That was another way of looking at this. He hates hoarding and stinginess because that always relates to not only selfishness, but a lack of dependence and trust in God. He loves extravagance and generosity because it forces us to be more dependent and trusting of God. You see how that works? And there's a balance here. I'm not minimizing the need for us to plan. I'm simply saying that God is pleased when we take the risk of giving it away. He is pleased. And this thing that happened on the 30th of April is something that we'll never forget. It's one of those moments you cannot repeat. You can't go back, let's do that again, you know. Those are gifts of life. I'm sure you can all think of moments that were magical like that. And you know, even in the process, I remember sitting there saying, you know, it'll be just nothing. It'll be no time at all, and I'll be looking at this from yesterday and then a month out, you see? Because you cannot embrace it. There's something about time. You want to hold on to it, and yet it slips through your fingers. Time seems to be a relentless river that carries our lives away with it. Eternity, on the other hand, will be a pool in which you swim. It'll be a lake that you swim in, not something that takes your life away, but you will swim in it. And time will be a medium that will serve us rather than take our lives away. So I'm encouraged by that prospect and by that very real hope. I don't know if I gave you this little thing from Waking Ned Divine. Did I ever share this thing with you? Even if I did, it's worth hearing again. Waking Ned Divine, as you know, as some of you know, is a clever film about a person who wins in a tiny Irish village. It's probably, I think, like 63 inhabitants. He wins the lottery. And Ned Divine is so overwhelmed with, I think it's something like 63 million pounds or something, some huge figure, that when he sees it on the TV, he dies of a heart attack. His friends now, then Jackie O'Shea and Michael O'Sullivan, decide that he left a ticket behind. One of us can play Ned Divine, you see, and we'll claim the ticket. The only way we can make that happen is we got to get everybody in the village to go along with this. They got everybody but one woman who goes along with their scheme, because the guy from the lottery is going to come and check it out just to make sure all is on the up and up. And this one woman, she goes out on her bicycle, and she's going to a public booth, a phone booth, that is really not, kind of next to a cliff, and she starts to call him, and there's an accident that takes place involving the guy actually in the from the lottery. He swerves, bangs the telephone booth, and she goes careening down into the. And so that's the end of that. Now they're all in cahoots. So Michael O'Sullivan has been the one who is selected to be Ned Divine. You all tracking with that so far? So when this guy comes, everybody agrees that he's Ned Divine. The guy's about to leave, and just as he's leaving, because they thought it was going off, he hears something, and they weren't planning on this. He hears some music and some singing in a church. And he comes back. They thought he'd left the village. He comes back. It's the funeral of the real Ned Divine. Now there's a problem, because this guy walks in. Jackie O'Shea, who is Michael O'Sullivan's best friend there, you see Michael in the crowd. But Jackie O'Shea looks up and sees this guy, and he knows the jig is up unless he does something radical. So what he does is he does a eulogy to Michael O'Sullivan as Ned Divine. You all tracking with me this? That is to say, we have a unique experience where he can actually give the funeral oration to a man who is still alive. You see the idea? And so Jackie O'Shea says, "Michael O'Sullivan was my great friend, but I don't ever remember telling him that. The words that are spoken at a funeral are spoken too late for the man that is dead." Isn't that true? Why do we wait till the funeral to speak our love, our gratitude, our affection? Why do we do that? Why do we reserve our best words for people after they're gone? It just doesn't make sense, does it? "The words that are spoken at a funeral are spoken too late for the man that is dead. What a wonderful thing it would be to visit your own funeral. To sit at the front," which is exactly where Michael O'Sullivan was sitting, "to sit at the front and hear what was said. Maybe to say a few things yourself. Michael and I grew old together, but at times we laughed, we grew younger. If he was here now, if he could hear what I'd say, I'd congratulate him on being a great man and thank him for being a friend." Isn't that great? So what you have here is a wonderful portrait of what life ought to be like, to speak your gratitude and your love and your affection in this world. Why wait till their funeral when it's too late for them to really enjoy? Yes?
And on the flip side, doesn't the Bible say we shouldn't say great things about people at the funeral if they weren't good people?
Yeah, that's true. But what he said was honest. He was my good friend, and we grew old together, and we laughed together. And when we laughed, we seemed to be young. And if I was here, I'd say he was a great man because of the greatness that he was in my life. Yeah, I mean, that's true. You've got to be careful about what you say. It's like the guy whose brother was a terrible thief, and actually both brothers were horrible men and criminals. And the surviving brother says, "I'll pay you $5,000, that is to say, to the minister, if you will say that my brother was a saint. Most of you heard this, but it's cute, because the guy agrees to do this, and at the funeral oration, he says that, let's say the guy's name was Frank, he says, Frank was really a bad man. He was a liar, he was a thief, he was a murderer. But, you know, compared to his brother here, he was a saint.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632. Or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.